What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. Symbiotica.com.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves, so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Tenor girl goes shopping.
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, "She blinded me with science." I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And that slow, condescending shake of the head from Lauren means it's once again time to dive into a discussion about the future and invention and science and technology. And this week we're actually talking about kind of the spirit of invention and innovation. Well, we were kind of tying it into our buddies over at Maker Faire, and we thought, wouldn't it be fun to sort of talk about some of the crazy inventors of the past who have come up with really creative inventions. Many of these people are ones who worked on inventions on their own and either experienced amazing success, or we've enjoyed their inventions, though they did not reap too many benefits from them at the time. But we do, you make a point, Joe, in that episode that not all inventions come from like the crazy guy working in a garage somewhere. A lot of them come from massive R&D departments.
I mean, if we want to get real, it's not as fun to say, but it is true that most of the biggest inventions come from well-funded labs and R&D departments.
Right.
Which is because it's easier to make a living when you're making a living.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
So, when you've got the money where you've got endless resources at your disposal to invent, it makes it a little bit easier to keep going down different roads.
But one of the points I wanted to make in the video is that separating these two things is kind of an artificial distinction, saying, oh, well, on one hand, you have these big, well-funded invention projects, and on the other hand, you got the little tinkerer. I mean, these are two ways of operating that feed into each other. They're both part of the inventing spirit.
Right.
And lots of these inventors who, you know, worked for big companies were probably also hobbyists.
Oh, yeah. Many of them.
And makers on their own.
Many of them were very much makers on their own, and that's kind of how they ended up being where they...
How they got those jobs.
Yeah.
Sure.
So we wanted to kind of look back at some of the kind of the godfathers of invention in a way. And one of the first ones we had was... a fellow whose inventions may or may not have ever happened. There's a lot of stories about his inventions that could be completely apocryphal, and that is Archimedes.
Archimedes. Some of his inventions are more well-attested than others, I think.
Right.
But he's mainly known, actually, for his proofs, right? Like
yes.
Stuff about physics and mathematics, calculating volume, density, hydrostatics, so like how you... No, well, is this really made of pure gold or something?
Right, right. The whole idea of displacement and things of that nature.
Yeah, that you could figure out if something was pure gold if it displaced the correct amount of water.
Right.
But he's also remembered for all these strange inventions. One of them, of course, is the screw, right?
Right.
The water-lifting screw. And this is a pretty cool idea for the ancient world. I don't know how they figured this out. But.
Well, yeah, it's kind of neat. It's so imagine that you have an area of water that's slightly lower than where you would like the water to go. So, you know, when you're trying to irrigate a large part of landscape to make it farmland, this is obviously something that if the biggest source of water is further down, like downhill, how do you get that to come uphill?
You could just dig a really deep trench.
You could, but that's not necessarily easy or safe to do. So what Archimedes discovered was that by creating essentially imagine a rod angled down so that the bottom of the rod is underneath the water, and wrapped around this rod is essentially what amounts to be a straw or a hose. And by turning this, you can actually scoop water into that hose, and because of the way that the hose curls, you keep on changing what the lowest point of that curl is, and you urge the water up.
You force the water upwards.
Yeah. So it's essentially a pump in a way.
Well, the angle the screw meets the water creates a little sort of moving bucket.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's difficult to envision unless you actually have a picture in front of you. But and this is something that's attributed to Archimedes. And as far as we know, that is, in fact, the origin of this particular invention. But even this is one of those that's a little under contention.
Well, one of the big ones that everybody always remembers is the death ray.
Yeah.
The Martian heat ray.
The one that was tested on Mythbusters, actually. Where
multiple times, actually.
Yeah. And this was
people are passionate about it. We really want a death ray. And so we're kind of upset when it doesn't work.
Well, it's
I don't want a death ray.
No, but this is actually the romantic inventor concept that we were just talking about, because we have death rays. I mean, we have really, really good death rays that we can make with modern technology, but people are still, they're so attached to this idea that
it's
Archimedes made a death ray. So here's the story. Archimedes, say, wants to defend a Greek city against attackers. Well, how do you do it? What if you were to get a whole bunch of mirrors and polish them up? And of course, in Archimedes' time, they didn't have really good polished mirrors like we have now. So it would have to be like a highly polished copper or bronze or something.
Right.
And you lined a bunch of those up so that they all catch the sun's rays, and you angle them toward a central point to heat it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You're creating a focal point so that whatever the target is will get heated up very, very rapidly.
And this is actually, it's not a bogus idea. In fact, this is how we create solar thermal power, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like you just focus mirrors on something to collect the heat and turn that into usable energy. In this case, the usable energy would be death.
Yeah. Well, in this case, the usable energy is heat, and the heat converts things made of wood into fire.
Yeah. to death.
The various tests that have been done on this have shown that it's a feasible object, but it may not actually work in any kind of practical use. Like you could set stuff on fire
pretty hard in order.
Yeah,
to
you
make
might
it
have to wait
go.
A while.
Yeah,
I read about some mixed results. Like some experiments were like, this would work pretty good, but of course, when Mythbusters did it, it got busted twice. They just couldn't, they couldn't make it work in any reasonable amount of time. It was like they had to sit there for a long time.
You would essentially have to,
you'd
have to ask the Roman forces if they wouldn't mind waiting just a little while longer before they actually disembark from their ships and invade your city.
And also
a cloud.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
We got to start over. And, of course, there's just the fact that it would probably be way easier to just go and light the ship on fire or shoot it with a flaming arrow or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But, I mean, the idea of a device that could inflict huge amounts of damage without any visible sign of projectile was something that could easily frighten your enemies.
Oh, yeah. And, well, it'd be terrifying.
There were, you know, a reason why Archimedes came up with some, or at least why we attribute these ideas to Archimedes, and the whether or not they ever actually came from him, or that's a matter of debate. But the reason why all of these were coming from this guy, this brilliant inventor, is because he was in Syracuse, which was under siege for like 2 years by Roman forces.
Yeah.
And another one of his supposed inventions was a giant arm that could crush or knock out. Yeah. The idea being that you would be able to destroy incoming ships or foul them in some way so that a besieging force would be toppled, at least the naval part of it would be toppled.
And these are things that repeat throughout history. I mean, it's we've got at the Maker Faire here in 2013 a giant robot arm that crushes stuff, and you know, and everyone is always talking about a Tesla's hypothetical
death ray.
Yeah. And sorry though, Joe, you were going to say something.
Oh no, well I was just going to say it's funny how with the arm there's this great diversity of how people have envisioned it. I found some site on the internet that just had this huge list of different illustrations of the arm, and they all look completely different. Like one looks like a literal arm. It's like a big metal hand that's slapping down on the ship somehow. I don't know how that would work. The other ones that seem more feasible is that it's using a big sort of grappling hook. Like it shoots over the ship, and then you can pull it using the leverage of this big lever back at the joint.
Sounds slightly more useful, maybe, than just whoomp.
But who knows, you know.
And he certainly worked on things like block and tackle systems, stuff that made it a lot easier to move very large, heavy loads with just a few people.
Early simple machines. Right.
Yeah, and he's famous for his discussions about the lever and the applications of a lever. And, you know, of course, there's the saying that's attributed to him, you know, find me the right place to stand and I can move the world, you know, that kind of idea. And also, you know, there are other inventions that are attributed to him. His death, of course, completely tragic. That was the story that the invading Romans were sacking Syracuse, and that the Roman soldiers had been given the order not to hurt Archimedes because he was considered to be too precious.
Valuable. Yeah.
Right. And yet,
the Werner von Braun.
but a soldier killed him, and there are different reports on what happened. Like some people say that what happened was the soldier commanded Archimedes to come to meet with the general, and Archimedes refused, and the soldier got upset and then put a sword through Archimedes. And then there are other ones that said that Archimedes was carrying some equipment that he used in his experiments, and the soldier thought that they were valuables, and so he killed Archimedes to loot his body. At any rate, Archimedes was a casualty of war. And so the big inventions he had suggested weren't actually built, but that's one of those early examples of someone who was really creative and came up with some very out-of-the-box ways of inflicting huge amounts of damage. The next one I have on my list is similar to that, in that he took many commissions for instruments of war, even though he himself was not someone who was particularly warlike, and that's Leonardo da Vinci. So good old Leo came up with lots of different ideas. He did also improve over previous ideas, things that had already been invented, like ball bearings. That was one of those things that had been around since Roman times, but Leonardo kind of showed new applications for ball bearings for devices that needed to be able to turn freely without too much friction, and began to show some of the first really practical uses for ball bearings.
Da Vinci invented designed a tank, didn't he? It looks like a flying saucer.
It looks kind of like a flying saucer. It had 36 guns in the design,
And what's interesting about that tank is if you really take a close look at the drawings, it was supposed to move based on a big series of gears, and you would, you know, turn these gears and that would make the wheels turn. But if you really pay attention to the way the gears are laid out in the drawing, it would never move because the front wheels would be turning one way while the back wheels would be turning the other way. So you wouldn't.
What he needed in there was a transmission.
He needed to have some sort of differential. Uh-huh. But what some people suggest is that Da Vinci was a pretty smart guy and that maybe, you know, it could have been a mistake, but it's also possible that maybe he put it in there on purpose because he, one, didn't want anything to ever really, no one, he didn't want anyone to really build it. And two, he thought that, or two, maybe that he wanted to do this in case it ever fell into the wrong hands. Whoever did get a hold of it would not be able to make a working tank because if they followed the instructions in the drawings, they would have an immobile structure. So it would be more like a hut with a whole bunch of guns in it.
I guess in the Renaissance period, a tank was kind of like a nuclear bomb. He definitely
came up with other ideas that were equally terrifying in this. And part of that was these were inventions that were never actually built. And maybe it was just that you knew that Da Vinci had designed this thing and that would give you second thoughts before you, tried to muscle in on one of Da Vinci's patrons. You know, this is a guy who received patronage from various very wealthy people. And so one of the inventions was a 33-barreled gun. And so imagine a triangle, all right? So you got a triangle, and you got it mounted on a tripod, and across each edge of the triangle, you have 11 guns. Now, the idea was that you would be able to fire those 11 guns along the top edge, and then you would rotate it once, one click. Now, when it's rotated, those 11 guns start to cool, and then you can fire the next 11 guns. So now you fire it off 22. You rotate it. Now that second set of guns is starting to cool while you start to load the first set of guns, and you can still fire the third set. So the idea is that you are constantly cooling and reloading these guns while firing off the top level of guns. So it was kind of like a very primitive version of a machine gun. Although it's all still, you know, manually reloaded, and you know, it's not that you would fire all 11 simultaneously, but it would allow you to fire them in quick succession.
Right, and you know, in comparison to the muskets of the day,
right, where you would fire and then 3 minutes later you'd be able to fire again. I mean, if you were really, really good, you could probably fire, I think it might be as frequently as 3 times in a minute if you were really, really good.
But otherwise it was just like Boondock Saints style of just, you know, like drop the guns, pull out more, pull out more kind of thing.
Yeah. Like, why reload? I have more guns. And then he had other inventions that were never built. Things like the aerial screw. So, you know, Archimedes figured out how to use a screw to pull water out of a low area into a higher area. Da Vinci was looking at using the screw shape to try and generate lift. So this is sort of a precursor to the helicopter. And the idea would be if you could turn this screw fast enough, you might be able to generate enough lift to get off the ground.
He also tried to design ornithopters, didn't he?
Yep, which kind of a precursor to airplanes or gliders.
Flapping wings.
Yeah, flapping wings, and the wings were designed more after the wings of a bird.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, not stiff enough to actually create the lift that we would need to.
Yeah,
but
none of them would have really generated enough lift for anyone to get off the ground or survive a great fall, if that's how you wanted to start. He did invent parachutes, which would have worked. They were not built, but they would have worked had they been built. People have built parachutes based upon his designs and shown that they would have slowed a descent so that you would be able to, in his words, throw yourself down from any great height without suffering injury, although without suffering injury part may not be completely valid. But you probably wouldn't die. But, you know, Da Vinci.
Broken bones in that day were not a good plan.
No, you might die later.
Yeah.
Or you might just find yourself a couple of legs short. Significantly shorter than. The Da Vinci, though, was, you know, truly the Renaissance man, right? I mean, that's the guy we think of when we think of the Renaissance. Here's this guy who was an artist and a scientist and an inventor. He had sort of one of the leading thinkers of the day. And then Lauren, you have some information about another person who, just a few decades after Da Vinci, well, more like a century after Da Vinci, was really taking that role.
Yeah, Sir Isaac Newton, you might have heard of him. He built the first reflecting telescope. I believe that another fellow had created a design for it earlier, but he was the first person who actually put it into practice. Was also just doing some of the most important mathematical stuff, you know, really building the Western foundation for calculus and doing important work with gravity and light and
figs
and stuff. Yeah, he designed this this so-called orbital cannon, which was basically a thought experiment to explain how we could put an object in orbit of the Earth.
Oh, okay.
And you know, which in what was that, the late 1600s,
yeah,
was pretty cool. I mean, right, you know, and the design involved putting a cannon on top of a mountain so high that it was in space, so it was not really feasible.
Right.
But as a thought experiment, it was really cool.
This whole idea of that you're falling at the same rate that the Earth is turning, so therefore you're just constantly in that same position relative to the Earth. I mean, that's the basis of orbit, which is, that's a pretty forward-thinking idea at the time.
Yes, yeah. He also, according to some sources, was a great animal lover, and although, you know, he never really had any deep friendships or deep romantic relationships, that he had a lot of cats and dogs kind of running around in his life. And supposedly at Cambridge, he created the first cat door so that cats would stop scratching at the door and interrupting his calculus.
I think we can all blame Newton for all the cat videos that are on the internet. I think that if you were to trace it all back,
there's some contention about that.
Maybe
one, but
maybe you could argue ancient Egypt, but no.
Also, one of Newton's contemporaries, Robert Hooke, is occasionally referred to as the British Da Vinci. He was you know, again living in the 1600s to 1700s, and created what was also working with light and gravity in conceptual ways, and created just a lot of really pervasive, simple machines. He was the one, Hooke's law, the extension of a spring is proportional to the weight hanging from it, is named after Robert Hooke. Also, Hooke's joint, or the universal joint, which is a way of connecting two immobile rods in a way that lets them create rotational force,
gotcha,
around each other. Also, compound microscopes, kind of an important thing. He was doing a lot of research into biology. He was the one who coined the term cell in terms of like a unit of biology, which he was connected to the Catholic Church, and he was examining cork under a microscope, and the walls of the cork reminded him of monastery cells.
Oh.
So supposedly that's where that comes from.
Well, moving forward just a bit, we get up to an American, Benjamin Franklin, known for his inventiveness.
He invented lightning, right?
you got to go stand in the corner for the rest of the episode.
That's what they taught me in school.
Wow.
That's Thor, duh.
I'm just going to sit over here. I'll sit in the corner. You guys take over. Now, Benjamin Franklin, who invented many things, he's also known for, you know, his diplomatic missions over to Europe. He's known as one of the founding fathers of the United States. One of the things Benjamin Franklin, well, he didn't invent it, but he did improve upon it, was the odometer. Odometers have been around for quite some time, but he created a really practical, precise one. And the reason he made one was because he was working with the Postal Service at the time. This is before the Revolution, so he's technically working for the British authorities at this point. And they were having trouble figuring out how to get mail from various cities and in a way that was efficient and made sense.
Wasn't Franklin the first Postmaster General?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we think about him when we talk about the post office as well. But so what he did was he actually designed this odometer. It was a set of gears that would fit on against the rear wheel of his horse-drawn carriage. And he took the carriage between cities, and every 400 revolutions of the wheel would be equivalent to a mile or 1.6 kilometers. And it turned out to be pretty accurate. And so he was able to measure the distance between the different cities, and with those measurements start to help plan out more efficient routes so that mail carrying even made sense in a place as spread out as the United States. And so that was a pretty cool early invention. He's also known, of course, for the invention of the Franklin stove.
Mm-hmm.
He was working in Philadelphia at the time, which, if you are unaware, during winter can get a bit chilly. And fireplaces are not terribly efficient at generating heat in a way that is useful for us. A lot of that heat just goes straight up the chimney, so you're losing a lot of the energy that you are trying to generate, which meant that you were going through a lot more fuel for a lot less heat.
Wouldn't it be great if you could just like heat up something thick in your house?
Which is exactly what he did. He came up with this idea of the Franklin stove, which was much more efficient at distributing heat and at preserving fuel. So you didn't have to, you know, start ranging even further out from Philadelphia in order to gather the fuel you need to stay warm. And then he also, of course, was famous for inventing bifocals. He had trouble both with nearsightedness and farsightedness toward the latter part of his life, and so he essentially took glasses for farsightedness and glasses for nearsightedness, cut the lenses, and then put them together, and that was the basic design for bifocals for decades. And I mean, it was one of those things where out of necessity he invented. So now, the next person I have on my list is another American, someone who the only U.S. president to ever have received a patent, and that, of course, is Abraham Lincoln. He received a patent for a method of helping ships navigate shallow waters or things that are like in a river that a boat would need to get over or around. And so it really was a design to try and prevent ships from or boats from grounding or getting stranded. And his invention was pretty clever. It was a series of waterproof bladders that could be inflated. So what you would do is inflate the bladders and create more clearance between the bottom of the boat and whatever.
And kind of push off. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like if the river gets pretty shallow, you inflate these, you raise the level of the bottom of the ship or bottom of the boat. I shouldn't say ship. I should just say boat because we're talking rivers here. And it would give enough clearance so that you could get through the shallow parts without the boat just grounding. But that's interesting. You know, the only president who holds a patent, so far anyway. And he was known as kind of a tinkerer and an inventor beyond just this. But this was the only patent he was ever awarded. And then we've got three people who are kind of
all big, tied up in one another.
Yeah, big names. They were all involved in some pretty well-known competitions.
Yeah, rivalries. Yeah.
All electric personalities.
Yeah.
Oh,
I want to start with George Westinghouse, because out of the three, he's probably the one that people know the least about from a general perspective. Like, you know, everyone's...
They've probably heard of Westinghouse.
Right. They've heard of Westinghouse, but they probably have seen comic strips about Edison and Tesla. Thank you, oatmeal. But Westinghouse, people don't know as much about him, I think, in general. So he was the son of a machine shop owner, and he actually served time in both the Army and the Navy during the Civil War. He returned home after the Civil War to enroll in Union College, which he would subsequently drop out of. And then he started using his practical experience of working with his father in the machine shop to start inventing things. Over his lifetime, he held over 300 patents, more than 300 patents, I should say, not over. And one of his inventions, I thought this was pretty interesting, was a gas shock absorber for cars. So in the early days of cars, back in like 1910, one of the problems that you had with those early cars was that if you were to go over a bumpy road, and back then almost all roads were bumpy, it was a jarring experience. I mean, if you've ever been in a car with really bad shocks or on any other kind of vehicle that doesn't have any sort of shock system, then you feel every single one of those bumps.
Like being on a wooden roller coaster or something.
Yeah, something that, you know, has just got a lot of bumps to it where it's just not a very comfortable ride. And so a lot of the shock systems that were around back then all were dependent upon metal springs. So you get a bit of a bouncy ride, and it was kind of
jostling. It wasn't necessarily comfortable. Yeah. He used compressed air. He used gas shock absorbers or air shock absorbers that were designed to kind of to cushion you on this. So it was a system that a lot of luxury cars use now. I mean, they essentially use an updated version of that same invention. It's, you know, obviously a more sophisticated implementation now than it was back in Westinghouse's time, but it's the same principle. And he also invented air brakes for trains. One of the problems that trains had in those early days is that the brake systems were not accessible by the conductor, the engineer.
Oh.
They actually had brakemen who worked on the train, and so the engineer had to give signals to the brakemen for the train to brake. And sometimes these signals would get lost, which means that you could have a massive, horrible accident. So,
Just go past the station. You
know? Right. Best case scenario, you miss your stop. Worst case scenario, you just
hit another train
or something else.
That's funny. When I think back on, you know, trains, it seems like you always see them in movies, no matter how far back, you hear that pneumatic brake sound, the hissing and the popping, but you're saying that came along
that
later.
That was Westinghouse who created the actual...
Late 1800s?
Early 1900s,
early
19, yeah. It was an idea that involved using the compressed air so that the conductor, the person in the actual engine could use. So it's not that they weren't ever using compressed air before. It was that they didn't have a brake system that was accessible from the engine before.
All right.
The brakes were elsewhere on the train. So that ended up making him quite a bit of money. He also invented a valve that was useful to reduce the pressure in natural gas lines so that someone could actually have natural gas in their home. Because they could tap into a well and they could get natural gas, but they had to pressurize it so that they could move it through distribution pipes. Well, the problem was that if you tried to have your natural gas come out of your distribution pipe into your home at that pressure, it would be way too high for you to operate it in any kind of safe way. So he created a valve that would reduce that pressure so that you would get it at a controlled rate and not just turn your oven into a flamethrower. But you can see that all of these inventions are kind of wrapped up together in things like air pressure, compressed air, valves, things like that. And through that, he was able to build the Westinghouse Corporation, which branched out into all forms of invention. One of the inventors that Westinghouse
worked for him.
Westinghouse hired a guy by the name of Nikola Tesla. Tesla also for a while had worked for the Edison Company. He worked for the Edison Company while he was still in Europe, and so it was not part of the company that was, I mean, ultimately they answered to Edison, but Edison,
sure, sure. He didn't work for Edison himself until he came over to America a little bit later.
Yeah.
And then he had a falling out and then went to work for Westinghouse
for a while. Yeah. And so a lot of people credit Tesla as the guy who quote unquote invented alternating current, which is not true.
No.
Alternating current existed before Tesla was even going to school. It existed mostly in Europe. It wasn't really being used widely at all, and it wasn't being used in the United States, but, it did exist before he came over. He did, however, create lots of improvements that made it practical. It wasn't practical before, and a lot of the work he did made it practical.
The turbines that he was working with were,
The turbines, his improvements to things. Westinghouse's company was the company that was in charge of making transformers, and some of Tesla's work. Boy, it's warm in here. Some of Tesla's work went into improving transformers as well. So Tesla was known as an inventor. He was known for making some stuff that, again, kind of like Archimedes, be pretty apocryphal.
Apocryphal invention.
The earthquake machine.
Earthquake machine. That's the one.
That would be a big one.
Of.
Death ray that Lauren mentioned. Mm-hmm, the death ray in his case was supposed to be some sort of ray that would make aircraft drop out of the sky. And that his idea was that if you were to create such a thing, you would end all war because no one would ever brave the death ray because it would mean that they would lose immediately. You know, it's that whole idea that if you just create a weapon strong enough, you end war because no one would be crazy enough to engage in war.
To engage in it, yeah.
Which we've disproven multiple times throughout our history. But, he was also, there's also the legend about him creating the broadcast towers that could broadcast electrical power.
Wireless electricity.
Over miles and miles. There's no great proof that that ever worked. There are accounts, but the accounts are not necessarily reliable.
And I do want to make it clear that wireless electricity is a thing.
Yeah. We're talking about...
I think a lot of people don't even realize that you actually can harvest ambient wireless electricity, but it's you're talking about scale.
Yeah.
Can you get enough of it to really make
it? Not enough to power a city.
And Tesla's version was using a tower and then turning it on and essentially lighting up light bulbs that were 20 miles away. That's different than either using some sort of magnetic resonance so that you can create a wireless power transfer, or using an antenna to gather in radio waves and create electricity that way, which, by the way, you can do. It's just not efficient at all. You don't get enough juice there to really do anything useful. Mm-hmm. You'd have to have an enormous antenna, and even then, by the time you get to that, you're talking about pouring in more energy into building the antenna than you would ever get from harvesting radio waves.
Well, I did see something about some cool... I can't remember the kid's name now. It was a while back, but he was some young guy who'd come up with an invention that it would harvest ambient radiation from electrical towers. So you just go stand by an electrical line and turn this thing on, and it would, I mean, still it wouldn't get that much. But
yeah, at least then what you're talking about is maybe a system that could recapture wasted energy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. In which case you're talking about improving efficiencies over, established systems. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a fantastic invention. You know, it means that we end up getting more for what we're, what we're putting into it. It does not mean that we're, suddenly tapping into free energy or anything like that, but it's still important.
Well, even Tesla's towers wouldn't be free, would they?
No. Wireless. The idea was that it would, the conspiracy theorists all say that the reason why these don't exist is because power companies don't want that information to ever get out, because it would mean that they would no longer have, because how
ways
would you,
to meter that?
Yeah, how would you meter it? Like, if you're just broadcasting electricity, then you don't know who's using what, and you can't charge people. You could charge a flat fee for everybody, but that's all you could do.
I can believe that power companies would definitely be against this, but I don't buy the conspiracy.
Oh, sure. No. There's also, there was that brief period of time after he passed away that his notes kind of sort of disappeared in the hands of the U.S. government.
Yeah, the U.S. government ended up essentially commandeering his notes, partially because they didn't want it to fall into other governments' hands.
Mm-hmm.
There was definitely a conspiracy theory there for a while that the U.S. government was trying to keep it quiet, like the death ray and all this kind of stuff. But it may very well be more along the lines of they just didn't want some other nation to get hold of this and then take advantage of it and set the United States back. The papers were eventually released, so they were not held forever. Beyond that, we then have Edison.
Right.
Thomas Edison. He actually did invent quite a few things, although many of the things that are attributed
to him.
Edison
were invented out of his... He was more of a businessman, honestly, than an inventor. Not that he wasn't a terrific inventor, but...
I think it's a little unfairly vilified.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, okay, yeah. So Tesla on the internet gets lionized.
Yeah.
Edison gets demonized.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like I said, in the Oatmeal comic strip, it's very, which is a funny little comic strip.
And yeah.
Oh, sure.
And I don't mean to say little either. It's a funny comic strip. I don't mean to, I'm not trying to belittle it, but it oversimplifies the relationship between Tesla and Edison and their contributions.
It does. And the author has come out and said that, yes, it oversimplifies it. And I was making a comic that is the funny. And so therefore, please don't take it that seriously.
It's not meant to be an encyclopedia entry. Mm-hmm,
For some reason, though, this meme really latched on.
Oh, absolutely.
The thing about Tesla
and
Edison.
People had been crazy about Tesla for a while, but the Oatmeal comic strip kind of put it into a framework that people really identified with.
Yeah. And you combine that on top of like David Bowie's performance and The Prestige and stuff like that.
It's just a great story. You know, you've got
where Edison's like this mob boss. He's got goons that come in and chop.
Hey, spoiler alert! Some of us haven't seen it yet. So anyway, what I was going to say though is that it is a great story in that you have the idealistic inventor who is
the mad genius,
and he's downtrodden because the corporations are the ones that keep pulling the rug out from underneath them. The actual story is way more complex than that. And anyway, going back to Edison and talking about what he actually did invent, he did invent lots of telegraph improvements. In fact, one of his earliest jobs was working for a telegraph company. The story I heard was that he rescued a young man from certain death, and the young man's father ended up employing Edison in his telegraph company, and then Edison eventually, in one of his wacky experiments, because he did like to experiment with stuff, accidentally spilled some acid in his workroom, which was directly over his boss's office, and the acid leaked down and ended up burning holes in papers on the boss's desk, and he was subsequently let go. But that he did create some improvements to telegraph operation. And then his first major invention was an improved stock ticker, which he sold to the Gold and Stock Telegraph Company for the princely sum of $40,000, which back in those days was quite a bit of cash. Still not a bad haul, but it was a lot back then. He used that money to help create his first R&D facility, and then eventually he ended up selling other inventions and moved that facility to Menlo Park, which is the famous one that mm-hmm. everyone associates with Edison.
The wizard.
Though, yeah, he was the wizard of Menlo Park. And the other big invention, the one that got him lots of fame, was the phonograph. That seems to be Edison's invention. It wasn't that, you know,
have a team working on that. That was
right.
More or less him.
Yeah. Now, in Menlo Park, he did end up getting a team of engineers and technicians together. And, you know, he would direct the company, but a lot of the actual work in inventing, testing, discarding ideas, trying new ideas fell to his team. So while Edison was quite the inventor, many of the things, including things like the incandescent light bulb, were really the products of lots of people working together.
Mm-hmm. That's true, but to be fair, a lot of the people we think of as discoverers, inventors, are project managers. You know,
that's true.
People who were in charge of groups of people who were doing the hands-on work.
Well, especially the later you get and the more complex the technology is, the more important it becomes to have that team of people, because it's getting increasingly complex for a single person to do one of these things.
Also, we just have better records as we move up through history. And
that's,
you
true
know,
too.
I mean,
yeah.
it's harder to steal all the credit.
right.
Right. This brilliant guy who comes up with these amazing ideas is fantastic. Thank goodness he hasn't learned to read or write yet.
The impression I get when I look at Edison is like the name of the game was volume. So
right.
He is responsible for tons
especially
and tons
for the phonograph, because
of
also he had hearing loss, so it would have been important.
No, I just mean he had tons and tons of inventions.
Yeah.
And so lots were great, and then there are all these things that you'd look at and be like, huh?
There are these great wacky ones. Yeah.
The one I saw the other day online was something about Edison's patent for the single pour concrete house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was big on concrete. He had a single pour concrete house. He was big on concrete furniture. Other patents that he held included a pneumatic stencil pen, which is basically a tattoo machine.
Nice.
I've made use of those.
An electric power meter, which worked off of zinc cells, that would have to be changed out by the meter reader. An electrographic vote recorder that could have, you know, sent a basic on-off signal to record votes, like, for example, from the lobby of Congress or something like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Not one of those Diebold voting machines.
No, I like that.
We could do a whole show about that. But moving on from our great triumvirate of Tesla, Westinghouse, and Edison, the next name I have is Philo Farnsworth, which is funny because we're talking about television here, an electronic television. Now, a lot of different people were working on the idea of television at this time, and this time being like in the early 20th century. A lot of different people from all over the world were working on this. And Farnsworth was developing ideas that other people had kind of started, and then he was picking up and carrying on. It's interesting. You know, he was 15 years old when he first thought of using a lens to focus an image through a tube onto a section of photoelectric cells. That was back in 1922. And then he eventually would file a patent for the idea he came up with in 1927. Now, he wasn't the only person to come up with an idea of this nature that would eventually lead to the way we think of television today. Because, like I said, there were other inventors who had come up with ideas for television, including some mechanical sets that weren't using electronics. They were using other means to try and bring a picture to a screen. So he was given the credit of being the inventor of television, but there are a lot of people who point out there are many other names that you could mention when you come to television in general. And this kind of illustrates how complex this is. Same sort of thing is true when you get to the discussion of who invented the radio. It's far more complex than just saying it's Marconi or Tesla.
Sure. The Mamba. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Don't you remember?
Yeah.
Mm. So the point being that Farnsworth, while we mention him as the inventor of television, the truth is it's far more complex.
There was like one common part he was most directly responsible for, right? It was like the image disperser
It was an anode finger magnetic coils that would move an anode finger with a scanning aperture over an image. That's okay. The specific patent.
Yeah.
And he also, you would have thought that the guy who invents TV, especially with how important TV is, that he would have, made $1 billion from it. But it didn't work out that way, because what happened was he gets the invention just as electronic TVs are starting to get some traction. The United States goes into World War II. As a result, almost all broadcasts halt. So just as television is about to get started, TV broadcasts essentially stop. There were a few markets where they continued, but as a nation, it kind of ended. So suddenly he didn't have any money coming in from licensing. By the time World War II ends, his patent had entered into public domain. So no one had to pay him licenses, because now it's public domain information. Patents don't last forever.
Sure.
So
they do last longer now than they used to, right?
I think it's the same amount of time, actually. Remember, it was 1927 was when he filed for the patent, and we're talking 1946, really, at the end of the war.
Yeah,
I think there's more
copyright.
You're thinking copyright, which has changed dramatically, but patents have been pretty much the same. The interesting thing to me is that he got so disillusioned by how this turned out that he, according to his wife, would not even allow the use of the word television in the home because he was burned by it. I mean, it was his work that was being used, and he didn't really benefit from it. Toward the end of his life, he died in 1971. Toward the end of his life, he was actually working on a different idea that we're still kind of hoping will pan out, which is using atomic fusion as a means of generating power. So he was invited to be part of the Manhattan Project, but turned it down.
Oh, wow.
Supposedly.
Hmm.
I mean, he definitely turned it down if he were in fact invited. The invitation part is the supposedly. And then we've got some information about some wacky, crazy inventions that weren't intended.
Wacky, crazy?
Well, one of them's silly, at least.
Yeah.
So, Segway.
Speaking of, in the video we talked about how, so there were all these things where, people were messing around, doing their thing, and they discovered something important. But it also goes the other way, right?
Like, they were trying to discover something important, or working towards something important, and then...
Yeah, and accidentally discovered something really fun. One of my favorite examples is the Super Soaker.
Mm-hmm.
So, water gun, I used them when I was a kid. I thought it was great because the thing sprays so hard it kind of hurts.
Yeah.
And what you really want to do with the gun is inflict pain, but it's hard to do that when it's a regular squirt gun, unless you get them right in the eyes.
Right, so, or you're filling it with lemon juice or something.
Yeah, or anything caustic, yeah.
Strickland played dirty as a kid.
No, I didn't. I'm just saying that if you wanted to, I did not want to. Unlike Joe, I did not wish to inflict harm.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. So you've got the Super Soaker. Where did it come from? Turns out it was invented by accident by a nuclear engineer named Lonnie Johnson. And he was an engineer who had worked for NASA before, and he was trying to design a cooling pump.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way he thought he could design this cooling pump was to use water to compressed water to disperse heat.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was testing a prototype at home, he was shooting the water out of the tank and it went, psst, you know, crazy
really
hard.
Yeah.
Extreme. Yeah.
And he thought, wow, that'd make a great water gun. Boom.
Yep.
There's your fortune.
Change tracks. Go from, the cooling pump to the water gun market.
To the child sadist route.
He made crazy bank on that.
Yeah.
But we also mentioned
There's this, so we were talking about World War II earlier Farnsworth. A couple of inventions came out of World War II era efforts. One was the Slinky, which was supposed to be, originally it was a steel torsion spring. And if you can imagine this, what it was supposed to do was stabilize a naval instrument. So if you imagine you're out on the ocean in rough weather and the ship's being tossed around a lot, how do you keep your instrument stable?
It absorbs some of the energy to prevent.
Exactly. So you'd hang it from a thing like a slinky, and then it wouldn't be shaken.
Right. It ends up counteracting.
Gently undulating.
Yeah.
And rather than
But so what this guy discovered was, well, he had this little prototype sitting on a table, and he knocked it off and just watched this beautiful
arc.
Yeah. The way
springs.
It traveled was just so elegant.
Discovered
the slinky.
And then
it fits on your back. It's great for a snack.
No, that's log.
Oh, yeah. But the same thing, really.
Right. Log, slinky, same thing.
Another World War II era accidental invention that turned out really fun was Silly Putty.
Which was originally supposed to be a rubber substitute.
Right. In World War II, there was a rubber ration because you had to use rubber for boots, tires, all kinds
Tents.
Of stuff. For the war effort. So what are you going to use for the rubber you need? Well, people were trying to come up with another way to make something like rubber.
Yeah, synthetic rubber.
Instead, what he made was a really fun toy that's cool to put, you know, in your sister's shoe or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, or if you want to, you know, pick up the funnies on the Sunday paper.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because you could actually transfer stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. You could pick up newsprint, and then you could also make it bounce. It was just one of those things that accidentally happened.
We got the names here. Yeah, the slinky guy was Richard James.
Yep.
And the silly putty guy was James Wright.
Yep. And, you know, the spirit of invention, of course, goes all the way up till today. We've got, you know, we mentioned Lonnie Johnson, who invented the Super Soaker. Of course, he was working on one thing and came up with another.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some great examples of modern day inventors. I mean, there are companies that are built on the fact that the founders were really enthusiasts who were trying out new things. Apple is a great example.
Sure, especially as we get into electronics, it's getting really.
Yeah, if you're listening to this on a computer right now or an iPod or something like that, you want to thank a couple of pranksters from the 1970s.
Yeah, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. Wozniak was, of course, the computer whiz of the two. Jobs was not that he was bad at computers, but he was really good at
the business side
and the marketing side. And Wozniak, he actually. You know, he was known as a bit of a prankster. In fact, still is known as a bit of a prankster. But back in the day, he was one of those guys who was really interested in learning how things work and then kind of playing with them.
Yeah.
So one of them was a telephone system.
Yeah, telephone prank.
So yeah, back in the late 60s, early 70s, really the 70s, was where it began to flourish. There was this culture called phone freaking. Freaking spelled with a PH.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to spell it.
Yeah. So phone freaking was all about finding ways to manipulate the telephone system, not necessarily just to make prank phone calls, although there were plenty of those being made, but also just learning that if you created certain tones on certain phone systems, for example, you could make a free phone call anywhere you wanted. You know, you would learn what tones the system relied on, and if you could replicate those tones, then you would be able to take advantage of it. One of the famous phone freakers was known as Captain Crunch because he discovered that a little toy plastic whistle that came in a box of Captain Crunch created the exact tone he needed in order to manipulate one of the telephone systems. And so that's where his nickname came from, was the fact that he discovered this. And Wozniak was known as one of the guys who was really into this phone freaking thing. And it was really more about, he had this insatiable curiosity to learn how these systems worked and to kind of learn how to do things within the system that the system was not necessarily designed to do, which is the very the very heart of hacking and innovation and tinkering. Mm-hmm. This idea of taking something that exists and then tweaking it in a way so it does something new and unusual.
Yeah.
And sometimes it with amazing results.
Yeah. I mean, see, people probably don't even realize that the computer you have now, you can thank hobbyists for that.
Yeah.
I mean, computers came from people who were screwing around doing something fun.
Right. Yeah. They were taking
personal computers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Cause before the microcomputer, we're talking about computers that took up entire rooms in a research lab.
That's a really good distinction, actually. We are talking about personal computers.
Because the macro computers, if you want to put it that way, were all being developed by universities at the time.
Absolutely, yeah.
And government.
And government, sure.
But so Wozniak built the Apple I for his computer club. You know, he was hanging out with his buddies in, I guess it was Palo Alto.
Palo Alto, the homebrew computer club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they would just try to impress each other by building computers.
Yeah, there was another interesting pair of people who would visit the homebrew computer club in order to talk about a programming language they had developed, a programming language, a variant of BASIC, which had been invented back in the 60s. Those two people were Paul Allen and Bill Gates, mm-hmm. who would go on to found Microsoft. So you even had Apple and Microsoft both coming out of this culture at the same time. Now, in one case, we're talking about invention through software as opposed to hardware, but the same spirit was there. This idea of learning how things work and then creating new things based upon those principles. And we still see that today. So I think that's a good coverage of the history of invention from a 10,000-mile high perspective.
Yeah. I do want to mention that, you know, all of our examples are basically here in the West. That's because we live in America and we speak English, and our research base is very Western, and a lot of our information comes from, you know, the U.S. Patent Office and stuff like that. And they have a terrific blog if you ever want to check it out. They mention all kinds of really cool random stuff, like the patent that Michael Jackson got for the shoes that let him do the smooth criminal lean.
Oh, right.
Stuff like
very
that.
Important.
So yeah, critical information.
I remember seeing that video and thinking, I want to be able to do that. And two broken noses later, I said, I'm done.
Yeah, it's shoes that hook into the stage.
Yeah, that's it. I did not realize that was an important thing to learn later on. Actually, it would have been more important to learn.
You're not quite a smooth criminal yet.
No.
You're sort of a rough criminal.
Yeah.
A rough delinquent.
I think delinquent is probably the best phrase to use. So, there are a lot of, like you were saying, Lauren, there are a lot of inventions that have come out from other parts of the world, obviously, and they have been
key. And other
key.
Famous tinkerers that are terrific, but.
Yeah, there have been some fantastic examples, but, we were looking at this from a Western perspective just because that's where we're from, not to suggest that that's the only perspective.
Absolutely.
But anyway, that's kind of a roundup of just some of the people we were thinking of when we were talking about the spirit of invention and innovation. And in our next show, we're going to start talking about some of the really fun, crazy inventions that people have come up with as part of the Maker Faire movement. And I can't wait to talk about them because some of them are not practical at all and incredibly awesome, kind of like me. All right, so that wraps this up. Guys, if you have enjoyed this show, let us know. Send us an email. Let us know what you would like us to talk about in the future. Our email address is fwthinking@discovery.com. Go to fwthinking.com for all the videos, the blog posts, the podcasts, and all the other information we've got there. We've got some really great articles linked on there that I think you'll enjoy. So go check it out and let us know what you think. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? a wine country.
Heck yeah, and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait.
Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Ah, thinking about gas mileage. You know, changing your oil with a full synthetic oil like Castrol Edge can help your engine get more miles. Right now, you can get 5 quarts with an STP Extended Life Oil Filter for only $36.99. Get started on your next job today with the parts you need when you need them at AutoZone or AutoZone.com.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.